Welcome back to the second half of our essay contest. Starting out the lineup, we have Perry. Perry uses in his essay a well-known letter from the Civil War to illustrate the nature of perception and how that can be controlled and manipulated.
The element of emotion, as it informs religion and prayer. Dear Sarah, the indications are very strong that we shall move in a few days, perhaps tomorrow. I feel impelled to write a few lines that might fall under your eye when I am no more. Sullivan Ballou was killed a week later at the First Battle of Bull Run. This story is a very honest letter and is very emotional to demonstrate the power of emotion. I'll take the same reading and mix in music. A week before the Battle of Bull Run, Sullivan Ballou, a major in the 2nd Rhode Island Volunteers, wrote home to his wife in Smithfield, July 14, 1861, Washington, D.C. Dear Sarah, the indications are very strong that we shall move in a few days, perhaps tomorrow. At least I shall not be able to write you again. I feel impelled to write a few lines that might fall under your eye when I am no more. I have no misgivings about, or lack of confidence in the cause in which I am engaged. My courage does not halt or falter. I know America's civilization now leans on the triumph of the government, and how great a debt we owe to those who went before us through the blood and the suffering of the Revolution. I am willing, perfectly willing, to lay down all my joys in this life to maintain this government and to pay that debt. Sarah, my love for you is deathless. It seems to bind me with mighty cables that nothing but omnipotence can break. And yet, my love of country comes over me like a strong wind and bears me irresistibly with all those chains to the battlefield. The memory of all the blissful moments I've enjoyed with you come crowding over me, and I feel most deeply grateful to God and you that have enjoyed them for so long. And how hard it is for me to give up and burn to ashes the hopes of future years, when, God willing, we might still have lived and loved together and see our boys grow up in honorable manhood around us. If I do not return, my dear Sarah, never forget how much I loved you, nor that when my last breath escapes me on the battlefield, it will whisper your name. Forgive my many faults, my many pains I have caused you. How thoughtless, how foolish I have sometimes been. But, oh Sarah, if the dead can come back to this earth and flit unseen around those they love, I shall always be with you. In the brightest day and the darkest night. Always. Always. And when the soft breeze fans your cheek, it shall be my breath. Or the cool air, your throbbing temple, it shall be my spirit passing by. Sarah, do not mourn me dead. Think I am gone, and wait for me, for we shall meet again. Sullivan Ballou was killed a week later at the First Battle of Bull Run. To demonstrate further the power of emotion,
add sound effects,
and a professional narrator, along with a musical score that matches the meter and the tempo of the script.
A week before the Battle of Bull Run, Sullivan Ballou, a major in the 2nd Rhode Island Volunteers, wrote home to his wife in Smithfield.
July the 14th, 1861, Washington, D.C. Dear Sarah, the indications are very strong that we shall move in a few days, perhaps tomorrow. And lest I should not be able to write you again, I feel impelled to write a few lines that may fall under your eye when I am no more. I have no misgivings about or lack of confidence in the cause in which I am engaged, and my courage does not halt or falter. I know how American civilization now leans upon the triumph of the government, and how great a debt we owe to those who went before us through the blood and suffering of the revolution. If I do not return, my dear Sarah, never forget how much I loved you, nor that when my last breath escapes me on the battlefield, it will whisper your name. Forgive my many faults and the many pains I have caused you. How thoughtless, how foolish I have sometimes been. But oh, Sarah, if the dead can come back to this earth and flit unseen around those they love, I shall always be with you in the brightest day and the darkest night. Always. Always. And when the soft breeze fans your cheek, it shall be my breath, or the cool air, your throbbing temple. It shall be my spirit passing by. Sarah, do not mourn me dead. Think I am gone, and wait for me, for we shall meet again.
Sullivan Ballou was killed a week later at the First Battle of Bull Run.
The example I chose is one of a generic religious tone with a patriotic bent, which would tug at the heartstrings of most any American. I am not exhorting that emotion is bad, but when coupled with prayer in the hands of a fervent believer, can lead one down the path of destruction as well as exaltation.
Hello, I'm Spencer Kinnard. There is nothing quite as emotional as the music of Christmas. For over 140 years, the Mormon Tabernacle Choir has been singing songs of Christmas, songs that are central to the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints.
Logic, reason, and evidence should be the foundation of one's moral decision-making process, rather than cultural emotionalism. For example, this letter from Sullivan Ballou would not ring as true to a 17-year-old boy clad in gray and following the God that Robert E. Lee prayed to. When Warren Jeffs received answers from God about whom very young girls should marry, they were praised for not questioning the source of Jeff's prayers, or if one wife is enough. Adam Swapp felt called by God to bomb a Mormon chapel in his hometown, and his father-in-law felt God was on his side as he refused to submit to a warrant by authorities. John Singer took his rifle with him to the mailbox to pick up his mail and died during an unprovoked shootout where Singer shot and killed a canine officer. With Old Testament zeal, Irville LeBaron's answers to prayer was to kill Joel, his prophet brother, and eventually 30 other followers that believed in the special calling of Joel LeBaron, rather than his special calling. Let us not forget that Ron and Dan Lafferty both felt a burning in their bosom when they prayed and received private revelation to slit the throat of their sister-in-law because she was influencing their brother not to trust in their newfound faith. Anyone who lived with these people saw them frequently and emotionally plead to God to guide them and give them direction in their lives and help them rule righteously over those with whom they were stewards. No logic justified the setting aside of common morality of killing innocent people. No measure of reason existed for the cruelty of their actions. And most of all, there is no evidence that their answers came from anywhere but their fertile and twisted emotional imagination. Emotions that inspire us to love more deeply or to judge not others are appropriate emotions. When the prepackaged, conditioned cultural bias of music and the spoken word lulls us into a false sense of divine certainty, which flies in the face of logic, reason, and evidence, that kind of dangerous emotional knowledge is what allowed parents to blindly enroll their young men to become altar boys for pedophilic priests who spoke to and for God.
Crossroads of the West, we welcome you to Temple Square in Salt Lake City for music and the spoken word with the Mormon Tabernacle Choir and Orchestra at Temple Square. Today's conductor is Mac Wilberg with organist Andrew Unsworth and the spoken word by Lloyd Newell.
Leaving the church oftentimes creates a large rift in people's families and other personal relationships. Most of the time, those of us going through the process are not equipped to know what to say. We've never been through this before, and we've never been in this role. And unfortunately, you can find yourself in the position where your mere presence can be offensive to others. Listen as Stephanie talks about this experience.
I left the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints a little less than 3 years ago. At that time, I said nothing. I have said little since the day I received my confirmation from the church membership office. Now I feel like talking. When I left, I felt like opening my mouth to say anything was proof that I was exactly what I did not want to be. I'm not an anti-Mormon. So many people think that when someone loses her testimony at the church, she becomes a vindictive, spiteful person with an axe to grind against the church and its members. My voice was silenced by the desire to prove those people wrong. There was a lot I wanted to say back then. I wanted to shout from the rooftops that I tried, I really tried. Leaving the soft place that was my life in the LDS Church was the toughest personal challenge I faced in my adult life. There was nothing simple about it. There was nothing lighthearted about it. For months I wrestled with the desire to be wrong, especially in the dark hours of the night when I sat up alone and miserable. I wanted to put that genie back in the bottle. I begged for something unseen to come and alleviate my doubts, to tell me that what I was seeing was not really there, that the things that I'd come to realize about the church had never really happened. I had the sensation of standing on the bow of a speedboat, feeling the movement of the water beneath me with nothing to hang on to. The more that I studied and the more that I prayed, the more I felt at the mercy of the wind and the waves. What I wanted to say was that leaving the LDS Church did not mean that I was leaving behind everything that is good. I didn't wake up that first day as a new non-member with the intention to go out and do harm or to sin. Waking up that first day was strange. It was almost like mourning the death of a beloved friend, but all the while grateful that the suffering was over. My brain felt tired, and my heart was weary from the struggle. There was a strange peace in the middle of all the uncertainty, but it was just in its infancy. It would take several more months for the peace to come into full bloom. I did have moments when my anger erupted. I felt so betrayed. I felt so fooled. After a while, it would settle down and I would just feel sad. After all, who was I betrayed by? The members and the leadership? Who fooled me? President Hinckley? Joseph Smith? Myself? Even though my anger could certainly find temporary targets, it usually dissipated into a nebulous sadness. There was a lot that I wanted to say to the people that I loved who felt left behind. If I could say it straight to them, I would tell them what I had wanted to say. The first time that I came to a social event after my resignation, I was not ready for the look in your eyes. I came to show that my beliefs had changed, not my heart for my friends. It was clear that I made you uncomfortable. Had I realized that I would have stayed away. That is why I do, to this day, stay away. I asked you about it because I needed to know, and when I was told that my presence offended members who were there, it changed me forever. I guess that was the end of my childhood as a non-member. It hurt me so much that the eyes that used to hold me in love and friendship now rejected me, in distrust, disbelief, and even disdain. After a while, what I wanted to say was that I get it. I understand, and I don't hold it against you, at least not most of the time. I still have my days when it hurts. I loved you like you were my family. The truth is, in many ways, I still do. I left the church. I did not leave you. When the rumors began swirling, there was a lot left unsaid that I wanted to say. I wanted to rage, scream, and cry. You know me. You know my heart. I left the church because I felt like my back was against the wall. Yes, I had lost my faith in the truthfulness of the church, but I did not start down that road intentionally. If you want to know, if you really want to know, the road opened up before me when I saw someone that I trusted, someone that I loved, almost like a father, use his leadership to act in a way that was entirely the opposite of the way that I've always believed that Christ would have acted. Not the Christ who sets out unending rules and principles of behavior and obedience. The Christ that I mean is the one that would have gone after the one as the 99 grazed peacefully. The Christ that I mean is the one who invited in the sufferer, who dried the tears of the hurting, who loved the children and held them close. What I saw instead was the representative of Christ go after those who questioned, segregate those who hurt spiritually, and cut off the ones who wondered. That is the current that I was caught up in, and I left rather than become the next to fall. It would have been easy if I could have blamed a single man, a single leader who took the reins of his office and ran wild with it. I can't be angry at a group of leaders who acted in the way that their religion instructed them to act. They were not hateful men bent on hurting me and my family. They did what they felt they had to do to silence dissension. I want to say that I blamed that person for a while, and then it seemed unfair. I refused to swim in a lake of poisonous hate. Now, I want to say that I have love and peace and happiness and contentment in my life, and I like the person that I am today. As a member of the church, I was pretty quick to judge those who didn't seem to fit inside the church's brand. I rolled my eyes at the expressions of faith from other people. People who lived outside of the boundaries of what was acceptable fell in worth in my critical assessment. Now I find a simple joy in learning to love those who are different. Seeing everyone as children of the same loving God feels so much better to me than figuring out how to make everyone believe like me. I don't regret all of my years as a member of the church. There's so much good there, and my years as a member shape the person that I am. There's a scripture in the first chapter of Isaiah that touches on the final thing I want to say. That scripture reads, "Come now, and let us reason together, thus saith the Lord." I want to say, do we have to stand divided? Is there a law set in stone that we cannot come together as people, maybe even as friends, no matter who we are or what we believe? Why do believers think that they are so different from atheists? Why are gay and straight so easily separated? Have we learned so little from the lessons of the past that we still can't overcome our differences and just be people who share the same air and land and time here on this planet? What I wish I could say is that I figured out the secret to loving everyone who's different from me. That would be a lie, but I have figured out that it makes no sense to me that anyone or anything connected with God would pursue compartmentalizing, labeling, and judging people. That is what I run as far away from as I can. I have not figured out everything, but I will spend the balance of my life in pursuit of that goal. What I really wanted to say is that my heart is open and there will always be room for you.
We'll call our next essayist Roy. Roy deals with the issue that many of us face who have both left the church and otherwise dealt with our faith in the church, that of evolution. Evolution is out there and can be a challenge and a trial for virtually anybody's faith. Listen as Roy discusses his dealings with this challenging issue.
I still remember my introduction as a child to the theory of evolution. I overheard a conversation between two adult relatives, and they mentioned a term I had never heard before. Curious, I asked one of them what the word meant, and the response was, "Evolution is a theory that an atheist came up with so he could explain how life exists without God." Subsequent exposures to the term evolution by many church members expressed similar disdain. Admittedly, the term came up infrequently, but when it did, it was generally couched in the same tone of anger and fear that would accompany words like Satan or atheist. As a child, I naturally adopted this anti-evolutionary stance. At about 9 years old, I came across a picture in a science book, that my parents had recently purchased with a small section on evolution. The section had an illustration of early ape-like men living along a beach and emerging from the water. For whatever reason, I assumed the illustration was suggesting that ape-like men had emerged magically from the ocean. I chuckled at how anyone could believe anything so ridiculous. I even ran to my mother, exclaiming, "I can disprove evolution!" To her credit, while she didn't go into the details of the actual theory, she made it clear by her response of, "I don't think that's exactly how evolution works," that maybe evolution couldn't be fully grasped just by looking at the pictures. It was not until my early teen years that I remember meeting church members that accepted evolution. However, these encounters only affirmed my belief that accepting evolution was a corrupting influence. The first was a Sunday school teacher who generally seemed like a good Mormon, but who frequently began the class by recounting the plot of the latest rated R movie he had seen. The second was a middle-aged man that moved into our ward and that was immediately known for being quite eccentric and blunt. He befriended my very devout family, and it was in the course of conversations with him that he revealed his casual attitudes with the Word of Wisdom, violent movies, questioning the general authorities, and even making friends with strippers. Though he, of course, insisted he never met them while they were on the job. As you can imagine, learning from these conversations that he also believed in evolution did little to dispel the idea that accepting evolution was not a sign that one was on the road to apostasy. It was in my senior year of high school when I finally had to face evolution, rather than a parody made up in my head or the caricatures offered by church members. I took an AP biology course, and what I learned made me extremely uncomfortable from what I now know is called cognitive dissonance. I soon saw that the evidence of evolution wasn't simply fabricated nonsense that one could easily dismiss, but that it had considerable evidence from the fossil record and other sources to support its claims. But perhaps even more troubling was that evolution not only explained how we got here, but also explained fundamentally who we are. It could explain our emotions and desires and even the attributes that the church considered divine. These things bothered me so much that I eventually stopped reading the course material and stopped paying attention in class. I began to fail a class, which up to that point I had done very well in. My relationship with evolution after high school was something like the relationship with the schoolyard bully. I actively avoided the subject, knowing it could beat my testimony to a lifeless pulp. Yet at the same time, I would never speak ill of it or those who accepted it because it had, in a certain way, gained my academic respect, albeit a fearful respect. I knew enough to know how compelling the arguments were in its favor. I had to concede that church members or others who accepted it had good reasons for doing so. I also met more church members who accepted evolution and who fully obeyed church standards and embraced the church's teachings. However, I personally felt I could not accept or reject it. I felt accepting and learning about evolution would undermine my faith, and rejecting it would deny my reason. I continued with this view all through my mission and during my time at Brigham Young University. It was only after I had lost my belief in the church and even God that the subject no longer terrified me. What I discovered amazed me. I found an ever-growing body of knowledge which confirms evolution and explains the exhilarating path of all life to its current state. I found the true narrative of my origins, from tiny single-celled organisms to fish to amphibians to reptiles to mammals and to humans. I found a true interconnectedness with all forms of life, and the true link between myself and all other human beings, from our common roots in Africa to the subsequent human diaspora into other continents. I also found why I and other Mormons hesitated to embrace evolution. In fact, according to a recent Pew Forum survey, over 70% of Mormons reject evolution as the best explanation for the origins of human life. I realized that just as I had feared in high school, evolutionary theory ultimately explains who we are. It explains why and when we feel anger, sadness, fear, happiness, pain, and love. We can see the complex interplay between environment and social interaction that led to our labels of right and wrong, good and evil, natural and divine. We can see that we are not engaged in an internal battle of an invisible realm between competing good and evil spirits, but rather engaged in a battle of different instincts developed at different times for different purposes. We can see that our diverse dogmas, rituals, and beliefs all help delineate social groups and to define the us that we trust and cooperate with and the them that we compete with. We can see that the promises of eternal life and exaltation or eternal condemnation are ultimately providing the perceived continuity that fosters ongoing mutually beneficial exchanges so essential to a social group's cohesiveness. We can even see how the belief in an eternal life as family units is an interesting metaphor of the actual genetic perpetuation Mormonism encourages. I even saw how God, in many ways, represents the real social group that protects and nurtures us as we devote our time and energy to it. However, for all this additional understanding, I remained with a troubling question. Is it actually easier for individuals to find their greatest potential happiness and fulfillment without understanding their true nature and origins? Can some, many, or most people actually be better off not realizing they are the result of millions of years of natural selection, but rather believing they are eternal intelligences created into spirit and placed in human bodies as part of a plan of salvation orchestrated by an invisible, omnipotent being? I ask this both because I recognize that many find great happiness and fulfillment within Mormonism, and that I myself also had times of great peace, comfort, and joy because of my Mormon faith. The conclusion I have come to is perhaps ironically a product of my own Mormon upbringing, but also because of my experience since I lost my faith. I believe that as individuals and as a society, we can best achieve our greatest and most enduring happiness, peace, and fulfillment, embracing the truth of our origins of organic evolution, and by creating a narrative for our existence that reflects the observable reality surrounding us. And perhaps I come to that conclusion in part because I ultimately believe, regardless of whether we personally feel we benefit from accepting that reality, that truth will prevail.
Leaving the church can also leave one feeling sort of displaced in a foreign place. Feelings of what is normal and what is usual can leave us in a space of chaos. Here our essayist, Alan, discusses his issues with dealing with his loss of faith and discovery of his new persona.
As I walked along a beach on the Atlantic coast last spring, my mind was flooded with an acute awareness of changes in time, space, and state of mind that have occurred for me over the past few months. For one thing, the idea of my being a seaside village dweller seems utterly bizarre and impossible. As a Westerner, my stereotype of beachgoers as laid-back sorts who said, "dude," a lot, had deep tans, and liked to smoke those funny brown cigarettes, made it seem a very unworthy and trivial pastime for a practicing Mormon, except maybe as a tourist. So the wet sand squishing between my toes seemed evidence of my emerging ex-Mormon status. I also noticed something else there on the sandy shore. You can't stand in one place for long. If you do, you start to sink into the ever-shifting sands being washed in and out with the tides. In fact, there is nothing about the beach ecosystem that is stagnant. From the very ground on which you stand to the life forms being shuttled in and out with every wave, everything is changing, all the time. These changes are not gentle or fair. Sand crabs who are able to survive the jarring crash onto the beach may get picked off by shorebirds before burrowing to safety. Those who survive must be quick, strong, and lucky. Whether the changes occur constantly and rapidly, as on the beach, or imperceptibly, as in the arid Utah canyonlands, all these things have an end. The constant swirl of the coastline is just harder to miss. On some days, I feel panicked by the disorder. I had always clung to the belief that there was someone, someone above it all, someone who could sort fairness and order out of this chaos, and reward me for resisting change, ignoring logic, embracing absurdity, enduring, if you will. Now I see that when a sand crab is eaten, it is eaten, that's all. There is no divine justice to be meted out, no cosmic score to settle. One life ends, and another is fed. And ultimately, my life too will end. I'm learning that, as when standing in the wet sand, there is a continuous need to reinvent myself. Just as my life used to be filled with nevers and thou shalt nots, now it is filled with possibilities, which are sometimes liberating, sometimes frightening. All these things I would never do. Get drunk, learn to work a coffee maker, do something active on Sundays, exclaim, "Oh my God," in the most vain way possible, refer to Mormon founder Joseph Smith by the irreverent Joe, or even something less complimentary, or enjoy watching my wife display cleavage, out in public no less. I've done them all. Sinful? Worldly? No. Normal. Normal choices. And not a thing wrong with any of them. As a young child born in the covenant, I was taught to have faith, to believe what the kindly-looking grandfathers in Salt Lake City were saying, and most importantly, to believe Joseph Smith. Good feelings meant that all these things were true. Lack of good feelings meant that, well, keep on trying until you get those good feelings. As a young Mormon, I had good feelings, and my parents, otherwise grown-ups, and some cute girls thought it was good that I had good feelings. Finally, however, I noticed that the best feelings I had were listening to music I liked, not hymns. Although my favorite hymns weren't Mormon hymns anyway, sharing connections with other people, regardless of it being in a religious context or not, and of course anything to do with sexual arousal, except for the crappy guilt I was conditioned to feel afterward. Good feelings associated with prayer, scripture reading, and Mormon meetings tended to be weaker and fewer. On my mission, a 2-year-long guilt fest, I learned that I could feel the Spirit, by which I mean I could carry out my duties successfully and convince others that I knew what I was talking about just as well after sharing an off-color joke with my companion as I could after fasting and praying all day. It seemed that Alma's seed could grow just as well on asphalt as it could buried in fertile, well-watered soil. Something was amiss. Now I realize that good feelings come from, wait for it, stuff that makes us feel good. We see something beautiful, feel closer to our fellow human beings, or do something that we can take pride in. Good feelings result. Sometimes feelings come for reasons we're not aware, but that doesn't mean that they're any more magical than normal feelings. If you spend enough time with Mormons doing Mormon things, you'll have good feelings at various times. I also learned something else in my work with the mentally ill and other troubled individuals. Namely, that I had a very difficult time discerning what was delusion and lying from the real thing. And I'm sure that the reason for this is that I had been taught to swallow the Joseph Smith story hook, line, and sinker. I met scores of individuals in mental hospitals and other treatment programs who related stories much less spectacular and far more believable than Joseph Smith's, yet they were quickly dismissed because the person's delusions were typically self-serving, had no corroboration, and the person generally had a poor track record as a reliable witness. When someone tells you that God has told them to do something illegal, illogical, or downright crazy, how do you know that's wrong? Eventually, I've learned to be skeptical of statements from my clientele over the years. Once I was able to do that and see how deception, whether delusion or cynical exploitation, is a common ingrained human feature, I was able to see Joseph Smith for what he probably was. And as much as I would have liked to have had Christianity as a fallback belief system, the situation there is not much better. Imagine right now compiling a history of the original pilgrims based on no contemporary documents, only second and third hand accounts from a generation later, which tend to become more spectacular as time passes. That's the problem with Christianity. I'm afraid that the main difference between Christianity and Mormonism is that Mormonism had to contend with the printing press and widespread literacy. I suspect that if there were enough contemporary accounts of biblical history, there wouldn't be much left that would inspire us. So, that's how my sand has shifted, from being one of God's chosen to being just me. Not chosen by anyone. Quite likely an incredible, spectacular accident, although one that is admittedly tough to explain. Somehow this universe went from Big Bang to a self-aware being, me. Although I have some idea of how, I have no understanding of why, or if there is a why. All I have is an I don't know. Yet it is a delicious, fascinating, dynamic, and exciting I don't know. And my I don't know of today is different from my I don't know of a few weeks ago, which is different from my I don't know in the future. This is why I will be shifting with the wonderful sands of life for as long as I can. May you all enjoy the shifting sands in your futures as well.
And finally, for our last essay, my old friend Nate brings it in with a discussion of, well, you'll find out soon enough, but this is an issue near and dear to Nate's heart. Nate, take it away.
Circumcision is the amputation of the distal end of the prepuce. In America, the procedure is primarily done on male infants soon after birth. A few weeks before our first of four boys was born, we were asked what we wanted to do in relation to circumcision. We had never discussed it. The doctor told us that many people where we lived elected it for their infant boys, but that no strong medical indication exists. With limited information, we chose to have him circumcised. We were motivated to learn more about circumcision when we observed our third son express discomfort and perhaps pain. We were preparing for the birth of our fourth son. This time, we had more information than the first time, and we made a new choice to leave our new son intact. Our background in Mormon belief laid the groundwork to understand important issues related to circumcision. One foundational teaching in Mormonism is the sanctity of agency. Each individual is afforded and expected to make right choices. The ability to choose predated individual life on earth. This ability was so sacred to God and by extension His Son Jesus Christ that preserving individual choice to follow God was preferred over enforced obedience. God knew that some would not follow His plan of happiness, but preserving the choice justified the cost. God in the Old Testament is recorded as directing circumcision for His male followers as a sign of His covenant or promise to bless them. As followers of the New Testament, we were taught that Jesus Christ fulfilled the requirements of the law. Mormon teaching is even more specific. In the Book of Mormon, the prophet Moroni records that the Lord told him that the law of circumcision is done away in me. With this belief background, it was simple to leave behind the belief that the procedure was an expression of meaningful faith. Sacred books we held as scripture abound with support for the view that the natural body is in the image of God. Among other factors, our upbringing in Mormonism supported our belief that our new son did not need to be surgically modified. Circumcision is simple and easy to understand. Parents of baby boys sometimes see a dilemma in whether to circumcise their baby or not. Several considerations may come into play. Is a religious point of view involved? Will the child's health, short-term or long-term, be impacted? Do social considerations come into play? Are ethical issues involved? Will one choice or the other result in a more preferred aesthetic? Should the circumcision status of his father or brothers make a difference? What about the child? For us, the Mormon perspective illuminated some of these issues. Most baby boys will not remember or know about their parents' choice. As they mature, however, a circumferential scar will be an unmistakable witness if the choice was to circumcise. With circumcision rates declining in the United States, a baby boy born today will probably encounter other boys and men with diverse backgrounds regarding circumcision. Perhaps most important, he is unlikely to know or have occasion to find out. For some people, a driving consideration behind ethical behavior is to maximize benefit for the largest possible group of people. This utilitarian or consequentialist approach falls short when a minority holds different values than the majority. Another ethical approach might be to value some behavior as intrinsically more valid than something else. When conflicting valuable actions exist, a ranking of these values must be made by the decision maker. Will parents more meaningfully express their commitment and love to their boy by electing circumcision or by keeping him intact? Another example of competing values has been resolved by legislators in many states who have determined that limited tax dollars have better uses than elective surgery. Ethical questions continue to be debated without consensus. While a parent or grandparent of the baby boy may prefer one look, the child, who will become a man, may have a different opinion. By leaving a child intact, his parents maximize his future choices. Consideration of circumcision status of relatives, be they a father, grandfather, uncle, or brother, places the parental choice in a different context. Should the baby be considered an individual responsible for making and qualified to make meaningful choices? Or will it one day become so? What about the child? Although a decision about circumcision can be stressful for a parent awaiting the birth of a son, it need not be. Circumcision is an elective procedure with questionable benefit. This unnecessary expense need not be perpetuated. Circumcision is simple and easy to understand, but we must become informed and choose.
I'd like to again express my sincere thanks to all those who took the time and effort to record their essays and send them in. They had to go and find the recording equipment and do it all themselves, and I appreciate their effort. I know I enjoy hearing from different points of view, and a lot of the thoughts and feelings expressed are echoed for me. As always, the discussion continues at our website. You can find us at mormonexpression.com. You can send us an email at mail@mormonexpression.com, or you can call us at 801-906-6722. Of course, this was done in conjunction with the contest. We'll be announcing the contest winner at our live show on August 6th, and you can listen to that podcast to find the winner, or check our website if you're listening to this much later. Thanks again to everybody.